A Friend from England, written by Anita Bruckner and read by Sherry Lungi.
Chapter 1. I first got to know Oscar Livingstone in fairly humdrum circumstances. He was an accountant, in a small way of business, with a few faithful and unambitious clients. I had inherited him from my father, who had also been in a small way of business, and I would go to his tiny office in Southampton Row once a year for a routine inspection of my bills and receipts. He would offer no advice about exciting ways of diversifying or investing, and I found this extremely restful, the whole transaction taking on something of the enactment of a religious office, in which both Oscar and I knew our responses, and after which we shook hands gravely and then relaxed into an exchange of equally ritualistic questions about our respective families. My own family was largely in the past, but Oscar was married to a woman who looked so remarkably like him that I had always assumed her to be his sister on those occasions when she came in to do a bit of typing for him. They were a placid, wistful couple, and when my visits coincided with their both being in the office, they would gaze at me with large, sympathetic eyes and commiserate with me all over again on small and large losses, both financial and familial, which I, in my absent-mindedness, had consigned for contemplation to the odd empty afternoon, or perhaps the late evening, or, more properly, had forgotten about altogether. So established was this ritual that the news of Oscar's astonishing piece of luck was all the more surprising, although it did not disturb his expression, except for adding a furrow to his previously untroubled brow. His wife, Dorry, had come into the office to help him bear the burden of his good fortune, and she gazed at me with an almost tragic fixity as she imparted the news. "We wanted you to hear directly," she said, "before the rumours started flying, although we did say we wanted no publicity." It appeared that Oscar had had an extremely substantial win on the football pools. They could not bring themselves to name the sum, but they assured me that they would no longer have to worry about the future, and then, as if to put my mind at rest, told me that although Oscar would be giving up his office, he would continue to see my tax returns if I would take them to him at his house in Wimbledon. "Oh, no, we shan't be moving," said Dorry. "Just a few little additions to the home, and something for our daughter, of course." When the time came round for my annual financial consultation, I found it entirely natural to speak to Oscar again, and the same queries were offered and answered, although he was now a millionaire. Rumour had, of course, escalated the sum into 2 or even 5 millions, and I, like my father, was now in a small way of business. The only difference was that when I telephoned to ask if I might make an appointment to see him at his house, his voice seemed to have taken on a nostalgia and also a sleepiness, which I put down to the fact of his retirement and the indolence bred in him from merely having to move from one room to another instead of stepping out each morning and encountering the challenge of a difficult journey on tubes and buses. It occurred to me to wonder how he had faced the prospect of working in central London, distant as it was from his suburban home, for so many years. As far as I could see, he was so unassuming as to appear endangered. He brought his lunch in a selection of bags in his briefcase, and did not trust the sort of food that everybody else ate, or was obliged to eat. Or perhaps Dorry did not trust it for him. Once, when I had had an early afternoon appointment, I had found him delicately peeling an orange into an empty box file, evidently designated for that purpose. And on another occasion I noticed a complicated bouquet of brie and something pungent and sweet. "What did you have for lunch?" I asked him, eager to penetrate this mystery. He answered the question with the same gravity as that with which he responded to my inquiries about value-added tax. "Dorry put me up some biscuits and cheese," he said, "and a slice of the pineapple we had last night for dinner." He had always impressed me as home-loving and uxorious, mildly inert, a bulky, soft-voiced man with beautifully cared-for hands, something about him broadcasting the resignation of a schoolboy who has to submit to an inspection before he is allowed to leave the house.